I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. My guest today is the Australian boxer, kickboxer, karate, so many things. So she started at age 12 with karate, then transitioned into kickboxing, where she won 5 out of the 7 fights she fought, and then found her true calling in boxing. I'm very curious about that because I would surely not find my calling in boxing. And then basically had a remarkable record of 41 wins out of 51 fights, including 7 state titles, 5 Australian titles, 3 Oceanic titles, and 2 international gold medals. And so many accomplishments for a female in that sport. When we got in touch on social media, Claire told me her story very quickly. And I thought there is so much in this that's behind the spotlights that we all learn to ignore when we look at the glory and the wins rather than the suffering and the losses. Claire Gabriel is truly an example of what sports will tend to teach you, but what you don't see in the background of being what Claire became, a renowned sports icon. Claire, I am very grateful that you're here with me today. I had to read, actually, because of the number of wins and medals and disciplines, which I have to say, I as I said in the intro, I wouldn't do. I would never choose boxing as a reason to be in my life. I hate pain, and I hate pain for me, and I hate pain for others. So what made you do that? Why would you pick up karate at 12 and then end up beating so many people in your life?
Well, just for the record, I actually hate pain too. I'm actually known as probably one of the toughest wusses going around. Like, ask my dietitian, I'm always crying when she plucks my eyebrows. I've got tears rolling down my face. I guess it's a different adrenaline. The fact of being punched doesn't actually hurt. So yes, pain tolerance either. It doesn't. I can't explain it. Everyone asks me this, and I guess unless you have experienced it, it's more the adrenaline of, it's a little bit of a shock, obviously, the first time you cop a punch. It's not nice, but it doesn't hurt. Like, I've got a few tattoos. They hurt more. Getting my eyebrows waxed, that hurts more. It's, I guess, you're taught to block, defend, so you know it's coming, whereas all the other pains, I can't explain it. I can't explain it.
So is that only when you're under the influence of all of the adrenaline, when you're in the fight?
No, even at training, you don't have the adrenaline in sparring when you're in practice, but it still doesn't hurt.
And does it hurt afterwards?
Sometimes if you cop a really big punch, then you can obviously have that whiplash feeling in your neck. But it's a different pain. It really is.
You know what you're doing here? You might be making me change my career choices. There are quite a few people I'd like to punch. Maybe if I learned how. So how did you get into it?
I was in high school in year 7, and a friend of mine at the time literally said to me, "My dad's a karate instructor, you should come and do karate." And I went, "Okay," and went home and said, "Mom, can I do karate?" And she said, "Karate? Okay." So, and that was that was literally it. And obviously, my parents are also Egyptian, so having a background where that's not the norm. Yet Mum was just always supportive. I was always a tomboy, though. I literally played every sport under the sun. But for some reason, when I started karate, I kept going. And I did it for 7.5 years and ended up getting my provisional black belt. But just really enjoyed the fighting side of it, but not so much from a violent, aggressive side. I love the art of the sport. So boxing's known as the sweet science. I love the making the miss and counterfighting as opposed to standing toe-to-toe and punching on. I don't like doing that. I love the art of it. So
tell me about that. Okay. Treat me like a total ignorant with all due respect, but I know nothing about it. Okay. I don't know. I'm not a spectator. I don't know who the world champion is. I don't know who lost all of that. I don't understand it.
No. And that's fine. And most people don't.
Yeah. You're in the ring and it looks, at least to the spectators, that the objective is to make the other person bleed, but your objective is almost exactly the opposite.
Well, let me just break it down first, because most people that understand anything about boxing look at professional boxing, which is no head guard, smaller gloves, longer rounds. Whereas what I did, which was used to be called amateur boxing, now it's called elite Olympic boxing, was head guard, bigger gloves, and looking after the fighter a lot more, because we would have to fight in a tournament as opposed to train for one fight. So all the big professional fights you see, it might be 10 or 12 rounds, but they go into a camp and train for that one fight. Whereas if we go to a competition, it's like tennis. If you win, you go through to the next round. If you lose, you're out. So you might potentially have 4 or 5 fights, depending on how many in your division, to get to the gold medal bout. So the fights are shorter. And let's rewind way back when I was in the prime of my career. Olympic boxing was scored with points. So all the 5 judges around the ring had a controller that had a red and a blue button. So you had to land a clean shot, and 3 out of the 5 judges had to press your button within 1 second for you to register that point. So it was a lot cleaner and a lot more technical about scoring a point. Yes, it's full contact, but it's more about points. Whereas now they've shifted the scoring to like the professionals, which is a 10-9 round, and you see a lot more fighting, which is basically fighters standing toe-to-toe and punching on in the center of the ring. You do get the odd fighter here and there that likes to move and dance and avoid being hit, and that's called a counter fighter, someone who will wait, be really good with their footwork, wait for the opponent to attack, make them miss, and then counter with single or double shots. And that was what I loved. I loved the art of it and still do today.
That's so, I mean, I know this will sound really weird, but that's so like video games, right? It's
I guess it is, yeah.
Which is my sport. I mean, if you say it doesn't hurt and at the same time, it's so technical. I don't remember where I read this the other day. The average video gamer in the online arena will need microsecond response rates to be able to compete. And I'm guessing that is probably exactly what you're doing when you're in the ring and there is a punch coming your way and you're on your footwork and trying to avoid it. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. It's all about timing and having great feet. And I guess that was actually my biggest asset, was my footwork. We used to go to international tournaments and I'd have other coaches from other countries come up and say, "Who taught you to move like that?" And I would just shrug my shoulders and say, "No one, I just do." Like, that was my asset. Whereas you can't teach, well, I don't think you can teach aggression. You're either born a mongrel and you get into boxing because you want to kill people, or I don't know, I fell into it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, as we Egyptians, we run. So yeah, so we're good with footwork. So I know this is not the proper question to ask in the age of wokeness, but when you were boxing, that was pre-women being accepted in Olympic boxing. So I'm guessing you got a lot of pushback on this.
Yes and no. It was more so, look, most people were supportive. It just was, we had a lack of funding. We had no support from, say, Boxing Australia back then, because we weren't recognised as an Olympic sport. And I'm going way back. I had my first fight in 2003. And there wasn't very many girls around. There were in other countries, like there were still world championships, European championships, and they were still big tournaments. But here in Australia, we lacked the competitors, we lacked the funding. And so, to be honest, I actually did a lot of international travel by myself. I just had this thing where I knew I wanted to be good. And when I heard the rumor of the Olympics in 2008, I went, that's it. I dedicated the 4 years for the debut of London in 2012. And went, if I want to be good, if I want to make it, I have to fight the best. So I just made it my mission, and I was so blessed, and I'm obviously till today extremely grateful for all the people I had in my life that believed in me and supported me. And I had clients who would go, "Here, I'll help you." And another guy in particular, who ironically I'm using his office today to do this with you, he was a bit of a manager and mentor for me and held fundraisers in his office to help me get away and fight overseas. And I did it by myself. I actually rocked up without a coach to multiple tournaments and went to compete because I knew I had to go after it. So it wasn't so much the pushback. It was more just lack of support, lack of funding, lack of trips. You know, the decision was made in 08 and the funding didn't come in until 2011. So I was I was the first female in Australia to ever be offered a scholarship with Boxing Australia. And I moved back to Canberra because I grew up there to the Australian Institute of Sport and lived there for full time for 6 months on scholarship. And that was the start. So from 2011 May to the, well, I ended up getting injured, but the Olympics was the next year. Like that's all we had. We had a 6 month window of travel and being a full time athlete. So we were so far behind all the other countries.
And you still had that drive in you to be doing it. I mean, what makes one do that? So it becomes very visible in sports, right? And I think if we can sort of visually translate that to others, maybe we can use it in everything else, but especially athletes. So I used to play handball. I never really, really made it big, but you know, I was always with the national team and so on. And some of those guys completely gave their life to the sport, right? I didn't. I had so many other shit in my mind, really, constantly thinking of mathematics and numbers. And, you know, you don't really do very well in sports. I did okay, but I didn't do very well. But those other guys, they had a spark in them that if you applied to any discipline in your life, you would succeed, right? What happens within your psyche that makes you want to win so much?
So I don't think I knew at the time, but obviously unpacking everything now later in life, peeling back my layers and getting to know me as opposed to Claire the boxer, I guess it was validation. It was I needed to be seen, and that's another story, but that comes from my, you know, my childhood and dad and not feeling seen, heard, validated, which is when I did get injured. Sorry, I know I'm digressing and going forward, but when I did get injured and I kind of hit rock bottom, that was my identity crisis. That allowed me to peel back all the layers of me and understand who Claire was as opposed to who Claire the boxer was. And the lady that I saw actually helped me see that why I chose a sport like boxing, because it's individual. Tell me I'm good. Pat me on the back. It's not a team effort here. I did it. And that was coming from a lack of, I guess, validation and not love, but being seen as a child. So,
so let's cover those two in a lot more detail. Okay. You mentioned you were injured twice. So tell me that story.
So my scholarship finished. Obviously I was thriving and on path to be one of the first female Australians to go to the Olympics. And we're 1 week out of the trials and I had state sparring. It was the last training session for the state team before we were meant to fly over. The titles were in Tasmania that year. And in sparring, I just had a heavier opponent. She had no intention of hurting me, but it was just one of those freak accidents where she was against the ropes and I was punching. And because she was quite big, she leant down and pushed her weight, because I was obviously looking down and punching into the body. All her weight pushed my head down, and my neck went into forced flexion. And I didn't actually think anything of it. It obviously, like you asked, does it hurt? If you cop a punch back, you get that whiplash feeling, but it went forward. And so that day I was actually with my husband now, we weren't married at the time, and he said, oh, did you cop a punch today? And I went, no, I said, my neck got pulled down. But I thought nothing of it. Anyway, it wasn't until the next day that we attempted to train. And I think just the slight movement of, like, all we did was a bit of shadow boxing and some light sprint work. And then the next day I woke up, I couldn't move my neck. So the impact of training just obviously triggered it off. And no Olympics, just like that, gone. Lifelong dream, gone. So
that's not an easy statement to say, right? You can say it now, but what happened then?
Of course, of course. I was shattered. Like I dedicated so much of my life. And even as a kid, like, karate was never an Olympic sport. Kickboxing was never an Olympic sport. And finally, I find boxing, third time lucky. And then finally, years later, it becomes an Olympic sport. So, you know, that's your dream. Most athletes, that's their dream, right? To go to the Olympic Games. But oh, at the time, like I said, identity crisis, loss of career, loss of identity. Who am I? Who am I without boxing? And that's, I think, sometimes when things are stripped away from us, we're forced to actually look in the mirror and do our deepest work, which I have. And yes, of course, it's easier to say now, but at the time I wouldn't have been able to say it. But I 150% believe I wasn't meant to go. And I would turn back the clock and get injured 10 times over, because it's made me who I am today. Oh, and it's helped me find my purpose. So I thought I was put on this planet to box. I honestly did. But I've realized that I was put on this planet to help people. Even though I found boxing again later in life, that was the stepping stone to really finding my purpose.
No, this requires us to go a lot deeper than this. So help me understand this concept of, you say, Claire and Claire the boxer. That self-definition, again, it's so simple for someone like you to see that, because it is so parsed out. It's so clear that you had a life that was Claire the boxer, and that all of your identity, all of your validation was centered around Claire the boxer. In the modern world today, most of our young people, even 30s, 40s, so basically say the generations that depend on the internet for validation, there are so many little Claire the something in their life, right? So, you know, the way they dress, the way they'll be influenced by others, the way they will try to appear online, the toxic positivity, all of that stuff, right? What's the difference between them? Maybe if you can tell us why Claire the Boxer again came into existence, and how did you spot that?
That was my ego. It was my alter ego, or as you say, Becky.
Becky, indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
So Claire the Boxer was Becky. But the beautiful thing that I discovered, because, and again, like I could take this conversation in so many different directions, but Claire the Boxer way back was being validated by that. Fast forward to obviously getting injured, going down a spiral hole of, I don't think I was depressed. I was down. It was, who am I? I guess just going through that identity crisis. But I was also telling myself so that was 2012. I was telling myself for a good 8 years, you didn't get to London, you're not good enough. So the whole not good enough from my childhood was playing out in my life tenfold. And don't get me wrong, we're always learning and growing and working out who we are, but I've done a lot of deep dive into me and who I am, and a lot of it makes sense. So I'm really fast forwarding here, but I was journaling one day, because there's a lot of things I've wanted to do with boxing, with life, but I've always stopped myself. And I think one of my favorite sayings at the moment is get out of your own way. And that was me. I was literally in my own way, stopping myself from doing all the things that I wanted to do. And one day I was journaling and I wrote down in big capital letters, what's stopping me? And I wrote, me, I'm stopping me. And the reasons were, didn't get to London, not good enough, no one's going to listen to you. And bless him, my husband actually said, can I have a look at what you've written? And I said, yeah, of course you can. And he looked at it and he said, babe, I'm sorry, excuse my language. He said, but that's bullshit. He goes, are you going to tell me that I'm going to use AFL, which is our football league here, obviously. But he said, are you going to tell me that any player that's made the AFL that hasn't played in a grand final hasn't made it? He goes, look at what you've done. And it was literally a moment of slapped me in the face. So then I started writing all the things I had done. Obviously, you rattled them off in the beginning in the intro, which was lovely. But actually owning that, owning the fact, look at what I've done. And I literally changed the conversation to, no, you're not good enough. Look at what you've accomplished. And from there, I was actually able to own my story rather than focus on the one thing that didn't happen, which was that final destination. Focus on the actual journey of what I had done along the way. So that then led me to share a memory came up of 10 years prior, which was in 2021. A memory came up, which was the 10-year anniversary of the first time Boxing Australia took women and men on the same trip it was when we finally got funding. So I was the only girl that went, and there was so me and five other boys on the team who were amazing, made me feel part of the team. And that tournament, I won all four fights, won the gold medal and won female fighter of the tournament. So I decided to share that memory. I thought, I'm going to own it. This is what happened. And that led to a friend of mine who I used to be training partners with, who now has a gym. He commented on the post and said, hey, Claire, the Masters Games are in Perth this year. And I had a laugh and I went, surely I'm too young for the Masters. And he said, no, it starts at 30. And something just lit up a spark inside of me. And I was speaking to Dom, my husband, about it. And he said, do it. He said, how much fun would that be? What have you got to lose? So I rang my coach and I said, who I hadn't seen for 10 years, I said, I'm thinking of doing the Masters Games. And he said, great. And I said, I'm not training full time. Like, I'm a mom and I have a business. I'll come down to you once a week and I'll do the rest myself at home because I have a home PT studio. So I've rocked up and had a fight. And then he said to me, the state titles are 2 weeks later. Why don't you keep going? Meanwhile, I'm 39 at this stage and I'm in the best shape of my life, mentally and physically. And I found boxing again without the ego, purely for the love of it. And I did it because I wanted to, not because I needed validation. I had already given myself that. I ended up having 10 fights in a year. And then, I'm 42 now, but 40 was the cutoff. So I found a purpose through fighting again, but for the love of it. And then met all these young girls along the way who, some of them weren't even born when I had my first fight. And now I'm mentoring them. And now they reach out to me and say, are you free? I want to catch up and I want to ask your advice. And I've not only found my purpose in helping them, but I've realized I have so much to give back to the sport. And it's just been an amazing journey, all because I got out of my way. And I guess I wonder how many times people stop themselves from actually doing what they really want or what they really feel in, you know, their gut that is right for them.
This is one side of it, but I don't think we should also miss the side of, and what have I achieved? Am I not good enough? This is this idea of not good enough, the way you explain it. Like, I couldn't count. I mean, I normally remember my intros. I just said, look, I'm going to miss the numbers here. Let me read them, right? When you talk about 41 out of 51 fights, that's the kind of performance that's winning every fight almost, right? And yet somehow our minds would allow us to deny all of this and say, but because you got injured, which wasn't your mistake, you didn't make the Olympics, you're a sack of shit, right? And I'm like, where, like how? And it's actually really, when you say it that openly, it becomes funny. Like, you know, honestly, what we do to ourselves in this world, you know, you take anything like relationships and people who would go through relationships and say, I'm not good enough. This is why it didn't work out. And reality is, as compared to everyone else, you know, you have to learn, you have to go on and so on. And that most of the time, the other person was also the sack of shit. And why do we do those things to ourselves? I don't understand.
Well, I believe it stems from somewhere deeper. And I know where mine came from. So my dad, bless him, he's passed now. But dad actually used to say to me when I was younger, and I'm sure you can understand being an Egyptian man, that when they bring humor to a situation, but he actually used to say to me, you're the best mistake I ever made. So I heard that as a child. I know, right?
He didn't want to.
He didn't want. I know. So subconsciously, I've carried that my whole life. That's where the I'm not good enough comes from. I'm totally good enough now. I get it. I've worked on it. But that's why people are the way they are, because of something that happened or an event that happened, something that's triggered them in their past that they might not actually be aware of until they start unpacking and looking in the mirror. But I subconsciously carried that my whole life. And I actually asked Mum one day, I'm like, what did that mean? Like when I started really diving into myself. But he didn't want any more kids. Like my sister's 7.5 years older than me and Mum and Dad were 12 years apart. So there was a big gap between them. And I guess Mum said he was just in that selfish state of, you know, Monica's at a great age now and let's just leave her at your Mum and Dad's and go out belly dancing and blah, blah, blah. And I was a bit of a surprise. So I guess that's why he felt the need to say it.
That's actually, if you understand the motives, it's actually a nice thing to say. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, it's bittersweet. But as a child, I'm taking that. So no, and I would just kind of laugh it off. But I don't think I realized how much it affected me until I started really self-sabotaging everything in life and just never feeling enough, always needing and seeking his validation.
Mm.
But I guess I needed to go through everything I went through to realize that the only validation I need is from myself. And, you know,
yeah, and the other side, I'm
42 now, and it's nearly taken me, yeah, I guess 38 years to work out that I am enough.
The other side of it, honestly, Claire, is, you know, hug that husband for me, because the way the way he empowers you to just, I mean, that's very simple, chill answer of, yeah, wouldn't that be cool? It's like, you know, go play the national championship. That would be lovely. That's such a, honestly, and I say that because so many of us hold ourselves back, because what's the worst that can happen? Right? It's a wonderful experience.
Yeah,
go hike that mountain. You know, no, I'm not that in shape. I'm never going to make it up. I'm rah, rah, rah. And so what? If you just do half of it, if you do a quarter of it, where's the issue? Like, why are we preventing ourselves from all of those things?
Yeah.
So interesting.
Of course, because I guess fear of failure. And I think the best part is actually Dom drove me to that fight back. It was the first one. I had been out of the ring for almost 10 years. So yeah, of course I was nervous, but also excited. And he said to me, babe, do you know what's different this time? He goes, if you win, great. And if you lose, great. The results are relevant. Your life doesn't change. And that was, I think, why I went, yeah, why not? I'm just going to keep going. And I had fun with it. And because the result was irrelevant, I didn't care. And I know that's hard because I guess most athletes are competing to win. I get that. But I had actually never enjoyed my boxing so much when I wasn't focused on the result. I was purely focused on the enjoyment of it and doing it because I loved it.
Mm.
So
yeah,
hard, I know, when you're, you know, competing for a qualifying event. I get that. But you definitely perform better when there's no pressure and you're just loving it.
Oh yeah, I know that.
Which I did have moments of, like, early days when I said I did the international travel by myself, like, because we had come from Australia, we were really nobodies. No one knew who we were. So there was one particular tournament where I was an absolute nobody and I rocked up and actually made the final. So it's just, I had no pressure on myself. It wasn't until, you know, later on the scholarship set in, all of a sudden there's an expectation on you, things shift. So.
But you see what you just said here. You said you didn't have pressure on yourself. The same external pressure was there. Like, the audience were there, the sort of return on your investment of training and so on, the cost that you paid for the trip, all of that was there. It's just you didn't have pressure on yourself, by yourself. Yeah, yes, it's so definitely interesting. Can I ask a very personal question? You can skip it if you want. Who's the boss in this household? I haven't seen the husband, but unless he's 6'5", I think he has to behave, right?
He'll tell everyone that it's me. But do you know what? We're a team. I think that's the best way.
That's normally what the boss would say.
No. Honestly, we are a team. We are better people for being together.
So wonderful. And how long now?
We've been together this year 14 years. But married 7 this year. And there's, like, I don't know how, where you want to take this conversation, but there's a story there. And again, the whole not good enough. Dom was actually married previously and had 2 little boys, and his wife passed away. And the boys were 4 and 6 when she passed. And I met Dom when the boys were 6 and 8. So that was right before London. So I actually became a full-time stepmom before I became a mother. Mm. And talk about a situation that life's going to throw at you where you're never going to be good enough. You're never going to replace a lost mother or father. But that was a lot for me too. That was unpacking all of that at once, the loss of London, loss of career, full-time stepmom. Who am I? So we've done so much work together and individually, and the boys have been a major, major part of my growth as well. They're now 19 and 21, and we have a little boy together who's 8 and a half. So I have 4 boys in my life. They say you're only dealt what you're tough enough to handle.
There you go.
I'm not sure.
I didn't say this. My wonderful mother, who's recovering well now, she fell, unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago. You know, was raised with my dad, who's an engineer, and, you know, I mean, raised my dad, who's an engineer, and three of us kids, all men, very manly.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I can relate. I can relate. Yeah. But it's very clear for me that, in a very interesting, I don't know if I have the right to say this, but it's so interesting in my mind, the vision of you being so strong, such a winner on stage, right, in the ring, but then deep inside, you would still feel I'm not good enough, that yep. image.
For so then, long.
Yeah, and then the idea of you being so strong and then having a man show up in your life and so masculinely, I would say, being able to sort of remind you of the things that you missed out when you were in that spiral of I'm not good enough, and to show you that you actually are, I think it's a beautiful story, really, to think about it.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And look, as tragic as it is, I wouldn't wish, you know, anyone to lose a parent at that age, or any age is hard. But I honestly believe I moved to Perth for him and the boys, because that was my destiny. Like, I had no intention of staying in Perth when I came here. I came for boxing and I said I'd be back in 6 months, and it's been 21 years this year. But I just honestly believe you end up where you're meant to. And
yeah,
it is from tragedy, I guess, comes sometimes a beautiful story. And we've just both helped each other so much. And even the boys, like, it's funny how, like, Josh, the older one, who I clashed with the most, obviously, because he was a bit older and he did understand what was going on. Corey was like, oh, cool, I got a new mum, whereas Josh was a little bit. But there's a lot of my inner child that was in him. So there were moments where we were doing this, but he helped me see so much of myself and helped me peel back those layers even more. So the whole thing's just been, yeah, beautiful. And although
it's so beautiful,
It's hard to say that, knowing someone's, you know, lost a mother. Like you said, can you change it? No. Can I accept it? Yes. And I think that quote in your book that I put to my story and you reshared, the one about gratitude, like, that one slapped me so hard in the face, because that was actually me. I was too busy focusing on what I didn't have as opposed to what was right in front of me. And what was right in front of me was three beautiful boys, that this was my family. But I think sometimes when you are, I'm not good enough, I want my own family, like, your head, Becky takes you everywhere. But I had to go through all of it to really, really understand.
Yeah, I can't tell you how timely this is for so many people, I think. It seems to me that we live in a world in general where everything's right and nobody's happy. It's quite interesting. Of course, there is so much wrong with the world, you know, in terms of the geopolitics and the economics and so on and so forth. But in a very interesting way, of course, your heart shatters in empathy and compassion for those who are struggling. But at the same time, we forget to have the gratitude for all that we have, right? All that we are blessed with, which is the majority of the, if people have a device to listen to slow-mo on in the safety of some kind of transportation or a hike on a Sunday or whatever, to listen to this conversation, then by definition, they're luckier than 99% of the world, right? And yet we continue to forget that. We continue to lack the gratitude and the appreciation for the reality of what we've been given, mostly due to no effort on our side, mostly due to pure luck. And it's shocking for me, because yes, I think our world is struggling, but we seem to be a little better. So that is a very big reminder. You said you shifted your purpose to helping others. Where did that come from?
So like I said, I thought I was put on the planet to box, but I guess from my own experiences, it's made me aware of how much I have to offer and how much I can help people. I actually find I'm doing it every day. So I run a personal training business based around boxing, but most of my clients end up in my gym in tears, telling me that they tell me more than their therapist. Or like, I think when you are living your purpose, it shows and it comes out. And I just know that this is what I want to do. And even this, just speaking, like, obviously I'm extremely honored to be here with you today. And I did a podcast with a friend just not long ago, and it was the first one I'd ever done. And I think at the end of it, I went, I really want to do more of this. Like, this is where I'm heading. I love the training. I love it. It's part of my DNA. But I know that I'm here to help people basically live their best life. And yeah, like I said, get out of their own way, because I was doing it for so long. I actually want to, yeah, I want to make a journal, and the front page is going to be Get Out of Your Own Way.
I think that's a fantastic book title if you think about it. And you know, there are so many ways people do that. It's funny though, because when you said that most of your clients are in tears, just took me back to the first question of, does it hurt when you're punched? But then
no one's getting punched in my gym. I just need to make that perfectly clear. They're punching the pads, a bag, or a box master.
Yeah, they do tell me, however, I mean, if I ever had a friend or I dated someone who was very athletic, they always spoke about boxing as like one of the top fitness exercises. It seems that this dynamic move of the muscle is very good for muscles. Is that true?
Yeah, and it's just a great release. Like a majority of my clients, I reckon 90% of them all train somewhere else. They might do Pilates or weights or circuit training, CrossFit, and they come to me for the boxing element, because it's fun. It really is. You'll have to do a session next time you come. The first time you come to Australia, maybe.
No, I've been to Australia many times. Yeah, many times. Where? I love it. You guys are the most laid back people on the planet. I mean, honestly.
Some people say that.
Oh, you don't understand, because you're so far away from the rest of the world, so you don't recognize what the rest of the world is. But Sydney, you can't have a coffee after 3 p.m. It's like the coffee people are like, is this slavery or what? We're going to shut down. Like, what? What does that mean? Honestly, it's like,
have you been to Perth?
I have not. Have you been? No, I've only been to Sydney, and I've been to the Outback in a beautiful place. Oh my God, that place was just incredible. It was a sort of a tent, but you know, a slightly upgraded tent, not super upgraded. But you're in the middle of all of the scary animals, and you really realize the kangaroos are really not as cute as they appear in photographs.
No.
And yeah, those guys look at you and like, I'm going to punch you. Like, they're very clear about it, right? Yes. And then at night, it was scary like hell, because all of those animals are either fighting or, I don't know, making love or whatever they were doing. And it sounded horrible. And then here's, take this. And this is the only very, very, you know, mind twist of that whole place, is that they had the Michelin restaurant in the middle of all of this that basically served dinner. So after all of the suffering of the night and then the entire suffering of the morning, you go to that place well dressed up, barely, you know, able to get yourself together, and they serve you those petite little things. And I loved that experience. I totally did. But in general, I loved Australia. I think I love the people. I just don't love how far it is.
We're closer to Dubai.
It's 37 hours or something. Is it?
No. 11. Perth to Dubai is 11 hours.
I can do 11 hours.
Yeah. All right. So you're going to come to Perth. We'll do a boxing session. And we actually have the best coastline here. There's something about the Indian Ocean. It's beautiful.
Okay, first to Dubai, 11 hours, and maybe I can retreat there.
Mm. And promise you don't need to stay in a tent. That's lots of nice accommodation.
No, not at all. So let's go back to purpose.
Yes.
You see this clearly in your mind now. It wasn't then. What is a typical change in a client's mind when you're working with someone and they suddenly realize this is not what they wanted to spend their life on? What are examples of what people are struggling with?
Do you know what? Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, a lot of it is self-belief.
Yeah.
and just, yeah, knowing what makes them happy. A lot of my clients are mums. You know what, I'm going to give you an example. I'm going to give you one lady in particular. I have a mums group that I run. So obviously all of my sessions are one-on-one. I have a few couples, but I run a mums group. And when I became a mum, obviously I wanted to create a community where mums could come and train and feel like they could come and go with no judgment. And so we've got a group chat and the class runs 3 times a week. And one particular day, one of the ladies said, I can't come today. And then another lady commented and said, no, don't leave me by myself. And then she said, okay, I'll be there. Now, when she rocked up, now this is a mum who has 3 beautiful boys. They're all grown up now. And one's moved away for uni and the other two are just older. So she is one of the most beautiful women I've ever met in my life. She has a heart of gold. She's always giving and doing for everyone else. Now, when she came to the gym that day, I said to her, I just want to make you aware of something. I said, you said on the group chat today you weren't coming. I said, and then when the other lady commented and said, don't leave me, you said, okay, I'll be there. I said, can you see that you're here for her today, not for you? And she started crying. Mm-hmm. And so we spoke about it. And I said, I had always seen that she's always doing for everyone else, never for her. And I said, I want you to go home today and write down 3 things that you've always wanted to do that you've never done. Anyway, she did it and she messaged me and said, oh, don't laugh, but this is one of them. I said, I would never laugh. Anyway, one of the things was something as simple as a pottery class. She said, there's a class up the road and I've always wanted to do it, but I guess she's just always put everyone else first. And I said, amazing, do it, book it in. So she did, and she's been going every week now for I think almost a year. And ironically, the pottery lady is now in my mom's class. Like, it's just recognizing that they need more. Or I just feel like I'm very intuitive and I feel like I have the ability to see what's going on with them at the time and help them through it. Another girl changed jobs. She was in a horrible job. Her boss was a-hole and just treating them really poorly. And I guess training and working out sometimes gives you that confidence to believe that you can do anything. I feel like a lot of the sessions we talk, we train and we talk. Then there's another one who's a CEO, 2 kids running her own business. And she walked in one day and I went, you do not need this. Like, I was not, her cortisol would have been through the roof. There's no way I was going to give her a hit high intensity session. I said, grab your sunnies, let's go. And we went for a walk and we just walked up and down the stairs and talked, and that's what she needed. Whereas when I was in my ego and I was personal training, I personal trained big tough Claire Boxer. I didn't care what they needed. I didn't have the ability to understand what my client needed. Because I've had my PT business since 05. It's like I've been a trainer since I was 18, but I was always training out of my ego. And so the difference was I made them cry because I was a bitch, excuse my language. It's now I make them cry because they're releasing or I'm helping them see something. And I think by doing all of that work on myself, it's made seeing it in other people so much clearer because, you know, you can't change something you're not aware of. So I had the awareness and now I see that in other people so much easier. And it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding.
I wish people would recognize that. It's just so interesting how just paying a tiny bit of attention to another person or to another person's comment or to the motive behind someone's activities or action. It's just so simple when you really think about it, but it can change a lot of things. And we get so preoccupied, not in the real world, but in our own heads and our own egos, that we want everyone to comply. It's so interesting. And it's funny when you really think about it.
Definitely came from that. It was only my agenda, whereas now I'm there for them. Obviously, and don't get me wrong, I don't want to sound arrogant by saying this, but I know I've done a lot of work, so I'm still learning. If something pisses me off, it's like, okay, what triggered? What happened? What was that? Whereas before, you just explode and you don't understand why you're exploding. It's not until you look in the mirror, do the work, understand where it's coming from, that you can change it. And I just believe that's, you know, everything we do, even with like having clients constantly put themselves down, like, oh, I'm so fat. And again, one of the ladies that I started working with when I kind of hit rock bottom. She was like an energy healer. She's the one that I did a lot of my work with early days. One of my favorite sayings was, she said, "Who said?" So it's always when you dissect it, it's always us. Well, I'm too fat. Who said? I said. No one else told me I'm fat. No one else told me I'm ugly. Or no one else told me I'm pretty. Who said? I did. So it's almost like we have that thought. Yeah, I love it. It's so powerful, Mo. I get goosebumps just thinking about how much work I did with her. She was incredible. And all her little sayings that I still use today and I still help with clients. And she even told me way back then that I was meant to do this, that I'm very intuitive and I'm meant to help people, but I was too busy being in my own way to understand it and recognize it.
This is so valuable. I mean, it reminds me of someone who's very, 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 very dear to me, who is gorgeous, breathtaking gorgeous, but doesn't believe so. And it's so interesting because in my mind, you know, I had a friend of mine, very dear friend, who was colorblind. We established that he was colorblind when we were in a meeting together, and he pointed at something and said, "Oh, it's very clear on the green column." And I was like, "There's no green column." And he said, no, the third column is green. And I was like, no, the third column is whatever, magenta or some other color. And now I'm hit with that thought, which my ego, of course, serves first, that he is colorblind. And then very quickly, I'm suddenly going like, no, I'm colorblind, because there are only two of us in the room, right? Yeah. And so I had to call the entire office and say, is this green, right? But you see, the thing is that when you're convinced, when your mind convinces you that something is not green, mm-hmm. it's absolutely impossible to convince you otherwise. Like everyone yes. would see her and say she's gorgeous, and she would still say, I don't understand that. I mean, a lot of people tell me I sound interesting. I still, in my mind, sound like a little girl. I'm like, I hate my voice. I swear, I know everyone does that reaction. But it's so interesting because your mind, who said I sound like a little girl? I'm the only one, the little girl. Mm-hmm. It's the only one that said I sound like a little girl, right? Everyone else says otherwise. And it's so interesting when you say, who said? And why? Why did that person say it? Like, why did you say that to yourself? Normally because of a conditioning or a trauma or something from your childhood. Yeah,
of course. Yeah. And it's so wonderful when you have...
Yeah, so wonderful when you have that support group or someone who's willing to listen and say, oh, no, by the way, that's actually not accurate. Yeah, you're actually gorgeous, or you're actually wonderful, and so on. Can you tell me, if you don't mind, again, if it's not too personal, so those who don't feel good enough will always try to control everything, the way they look, the way they're fit, the way they eat, the way they breathe, the way everything, right? Because they're trying to be the best that they can be. So can you tell me a bit about your relationship with food?
Oh, yes. So being in a weight category sport, I 100% had an eating disorder when I was competing, and I did not recognize it until I was out of it. So, again, I have no problem sharing the kilos, the weight. I boxed at 60 kilos. That was my fight category, which means I had to be 60.00 or under to compete in that event. I would fight, so it would be right time to diet down, starve, cut out everything. And it was that constant starve binge relationship.
I starve constantly,
got to make weight, starve myself down, start dieting, make weight, fight's over, right? In my mind, I'm going to eat all of that and shove it in because I needed to make up for what I missed out on. And I did that yo-yo for 10 years. I would fight, and then after that, would be anywhere from 66 to 68. One time, 70. I had a massive blowout after the World Championships.
Wow.
10 kilos. And then I was a constant yo-yo, up, down, up, down. And I used to say to myself, why can't I maintain 60 kilos? Like, oh, well, this must be my natural body weight. And then when I got injured, all of a sudden I could eat and drink whatever I wanted. I had permission to eat and drink whatever I wanted, but I didn't want to. All my weight fell off, and I literally was walking around at 60 kilos. People would come up and go, oh, you're looking so lean. Are you fighting soon? I'm like, well, no, I'm actually not fighting anymore. Oh, no one could understand why I was not competing, yet I was in the best shape of my life, because I realized that I was in a vicious circle, and I'm actually still seeing it today. And I think that's why I want to help and give back to the sport. I'm actually on the Australian Women's Boxing Committee now, and I want to help mentor all the young girls, because I want to help them understand that they don't have to do that. There is another way. Like, I actually eat and drink whatever I want when I want. I eat when I'm hungry. I don't deprive myself of anything, but everything in moderation. And yeah, like I said, I'm now a mum, to the point that when I competed again just a few years ago, I ended up fighting at 57, and I made it so comfortably that, go back 10 years ago, I would never have fathomed being that light. But it's honestly the relationship you have. But I definitely used to be that person that would use punishment and reward. So, oh, I trained today so I can eat that, or, oh, I ate that, I better train. And that was constant for a very long time. And I would also, like, just constantly beat myself up if I had something that I wasn't meant to. But again, meant to, according to who said. It's all linked. It's all linked. This is probably one of my favorite stories. I was 18 and I was kickboxing. I was making weight, and I had a diet written for me by a bodybuilder. Now, one day I ate a banana, and the banana wasn't on the diet. So what then came after that? Self-sabotage. You fat B, you've ruined it. Oh, well, you may as well keep ruining it. So then,
oh, wow.
I can't even remember. I can't even remember what I ate. But I know that so many people listening to this, probably especially women, but probably men too, can relate. We've all had that one thing that we told ourselves we weren't allowed to have. Therefore, what we then did after was 10 times worse. Now, I'm pretty sure if that banana was a piece of cake even, and the conversation ended there, there would have been no problem. My weight wouldn't have shifted, but it's because I didn't give myself permission to have it. I then self-sabotaged. I ate cookies, chocolate, you name it. I ate a banana. What is the banana going to do? But even so, like I said, have a cake. Enjoy it. That cake was beautiful. Enjoy every mouthful. Be done with it, though. The conversation needs to end there. There's no, oh, you've ruined it. Ruined what? Who said you ruined it? Just balance, moderation. And I honestly believe that if people can shift that way with their food rather than, and look, I don't make judgment to anyone who counts calories or, you know, is living a certain lifestyle, but I now ask, is what you're doing maintainable for the rest of your life? Because if the answer is no, then you know the minute you stop that fad or diet or whatever you're doing, you're going to put it all back on again, because it's the whole restrict, starve, binge mentality. And it's constant.
Yeah. So my wonderful wife, Hannah, is a therapist, and, you know, she understands eating disorders very, very, very well. And of course, I consider her my teacher very frequently, because my view of everything in life has been an engineered mathematical physics approach. And she just comes at it from such a different angle sometimes. And two comments popped up in my mind from this conversation. One is, she said, most of us have an eating disorder of some form, right? Sometimes it's very extreme that it requires intervention, but for most of us, there is some kind, and that all of it is around that idea of control. I hope I'm not phrasing this incorrectly, but it's not about food mainly. It's about the fact that food, if I manage to control my food, or if I manage to binge my food, then I'm sort of on one side of the extreme of that control spectrum, if you want. And it's the thought, like you rightly said, it's not the banana. The banana doesn't add weight or remove weight. It's a banana, like, seriously, right? It's that whole cycle that happens in our heads that brings us back into, oh, you lost control, you little bee. Right? Didn't we say this is not going to happen again? And then, of course, it's not just on food. If you have that attitude, it's on everything. It's like, you said this, or they said that to you, or you didn't go to the gym 16 times, or you didn't do this, or you didn't do that. And it's so, you know, it's just a very unusual way, because in reality, when you really think about it, you're not in control at all. Being in control is to actually force yourself to be in balance. Not force, but to find balance. Like you so beautifully said it, you know, eat what you want, when you want, your body will tell you what you need, eat it in moderation, because your body actually doesn't want extremes, and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And you'll be at your best.
And same with exercise too. Like, I was literally starving and binging and training three times a day and still struggling to maintain weight. Now I train maybe three to five times a week, once a day, and eat what I want. But again, I don't starve binge. Everything's in moderation. If I feel like something, I'll have it. If I want to train, I will. I just don't, there's no control around that. It's purely I feel and listen to my body. And if I don't feel like training, if I've had a big day with clients back to back, sometimes I go, no, I'm done. I'll train tomorrow. Or, and you know, there are a lot of people out there who talk about discipline and, you know, just get it done every day. But sometimes I don't feel like it, and I'm okay with that. I don't need to beat myself up over it either. It's a nice place to be.
It really is. And it's a place of mental health as well as physical health, not just you know, physical health.
Yeah.
It's funny in my mind, I have to say, that whole good enough thing is probably the biggest tormentor in humanity's life in the modern world.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And a lot of people come to me and say, you know, that they feel they're not good enough. And my typical answer is, yeah, you're not. Nobody is. Like, good enough. Seriously, like, what are you fighting for? The perfection is a myth, okay? And good enough for what? Yeah, good enough for what?
Yeah.
Exactly. So you know, I always say that it's 80-20. Like, if whatever shape, whatever kind of humor, whatever, any side of you, whichever way you are, 20% of people will think like you're the shit, you're the best thing that ever happened, okay? And 80% of people will hate it, right? And then, you know, you're going to control yourself and force yourself and be skinny and heroin chic and whatever, right? And eventually end up with a different 20% praising it and a different 80% hating it. But it's the same ratio. Like, what are you doing? Just be whatever the F you are, and you'll end up with 20%. Great. Just manage to convince yourself that the 80% don't matter. And that, you know, all you need is to have two people in your life that love you as you are. And that's it, really. So, yeah.
Or you could say one yourself.
Oh, that's the best comment of the whole conversation.
Well, but it's true, right? It's like, at the end of the day, what someone else thinks of you is none of your business. That's one of my favorite sayings. And
yeah,
you have to love yourself first, because what's the point of 100 people loving you if you hate yourself?
Yeah. And how can you not love yourself if you're so able to put so many measures of control and be so disciplined and push yourself and comply to what yourself is asking you to do? And, you know, in reality, just chill, like, really. And it's so interesting. One of the things that you said that really registers with me is I'm a bit like you, right? I dreamt of being athletic as a young man. Did reasonably well, honestly, for someone who had so much more on his plate. But I was never really an Olympic candidate or whatever. And I then, as of my late 20s, had this little injury in my ankle and basically developed a lovely little belly that never went away. Okay. And in many years, I constantly start the year with, this is the year of the six pack. Yeah. I normally stay with one pack, big pack, but yeah, that's what normally happens. Right. Here's the thing though. I'm never as fit or feeling better than when I'm doing what you're saying, which is, I normally take sugar out of my diet completely because it really inflames my body and gives me a lot of pain. But otherwise, I just eat reasonable. When I'm hungry, I eat. I eat as much as I think is reasonable. You know, I don't overdo it. I don't underdo it. And you physically observe it on me that I'm actually looking better, definitely feeling better, and sort of like removing 20% of my brain chatter, which is around food. You know what I mean? And it's such an interesting place to be.
100%. It's so empowering because like I said, the famous word is permission. You just grant yourself permission to be, do, eat, drink, whatever.
Be kind. You're wonderful.
So are you.
Thank you. Okay, I was a bit fearful at the beginning of
Is that why we didn't do it in person? You thought I was going to punch you or something?
No, I wasn't going to do that in person. You know that there is a very famous Egyptian joke. Probably you don't know it if you didn't live in Egypt, but you know the idea that if you upset someone, they'll get a few baltagiyya, which are sort of like the gangsters. You know, they'll gather up a few gangsters to beat you up. And so we joke about that when someone says something that annoys you, you go like, "I'll get the baltagiyya," right? And I was fearing that when I had this conversation with the boxing champion of Australia. It was like, if I upset her, she's going to send the baltagiyya. So, but it turned out to be amazing. So let's just say this I missed.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you so much for being here, Claire. Thank you for sharing so openly. It's been a lovely conversation, and I think really, for all of you listening, it is it just doesn't apply to a world-renowned athlete. It applies to all of us. I think what we discussed today, in terms of the ego that drives us to extremes, the idea of validation, the I'm not good enough, the episodes of control, this is really what makes us all struggle. And I think if you simply allow yourself to meet your real self, and allow yourself to be kind, to be willing to participate in what your real self wants you to be, you may end up with a very different person than becoming Claire the boxer. Yeah.
And find your purpose.
And to find your purpose. I'm very grateful, Claire. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And for all of you listening, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. Do take some time to reflect on what's your ego, what's the real you, what's where you want to be. You might be totally surprised, whatever it is that you do this week. Give yourself a little bit of time to actually think about what you're doing that is a little bit too much control, a little bit too little love for yourself. While you're doing it, before you put your device down, do the stuff that makes this podcast more successful, please, because we can send this message to more people. So like it on your podcast player, share it on social media. Come to YouTube and watch us there. It's actually quite a bit of fun when you're there in person. And comment and share and do all of the silly stuff that social media forces us to do. With that, I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.